Yo, what's up? What's the link between speaking and the adductors?
Welcome to Therapists in Motion Podcast, brought to you by Spooner.
Welcome back to Therapists in Motion Podcast. This is Dan hosting. We are going to have a lovely conversation today, one that will be very thought-provoking, and I have two individuals who are joining me as co-hosts because we have been having this ongoing conversation amongst the three of us for a long time. These are two familiar voices, Brian Schulte.
Hi, Dan.
And John Klein.
Hello.
And we are joined by our special guest, and we are very blessed to have him. His name is Dave Tiberio. He is a professor emeritus from the University of Connecticut, and he is the dean of the Gray Institute.
Well, thanks for having me. Always great to be around Spooner people, and we appreciate all that you're doing in the world of movement.
Well, we are very blessed to have you. Dave is here on location with us at our Spooner Old Town Clinic. And today's conversation, again, kind of like I alluded to, Brian, John, and I have been having this ongoing conversation for a long time about how we utilize the proprioceptive system and the knowledge of the proprioceptors for training movement, for understanding stretching, for understanding something called the transformational zone and how we train safely within the transformational zone or around the transformational zone. And we decided, because the guru of proprioceptors is really Dave, that we're taking advantage of him being in town for a Parkinson's retreat, and decided to bring him on location. So the first question, and then we'll kind of go from here, Dave, really is, okay, we all understand that we need mobility in our systems. We need flexibility. We need muscle length. We need soft tissue length. We need fascia length. Because our body has to have that for a resource. So this is a two-part question. What do we do to improve that mobility? And then how do we have our body use and train it after we give it mobility?
Well, you did a great job covering all of the different tissues in which we need some sort of motion or mobility. And there's a lot of different terms, flexibility. How do we increase that? Do we do stretching? You know, this. Different approaches to that, but I think when you consider all of those tissues, we're going to have to work locally a little bit, dependent upon the tissue, if we know it, the tissue that's limiting the motion in a particular region of the body. So we might call that at the Gray Institute, and certainly anywhere else, a local impairment, something that's suboptimal, and it could be any of those things or all of them at one particular anatomical location. And then we have to say, how do we enhance the body's resources? So if we look at each one of those things contributing to a resource, so a resource might be, in this case, motion we're really focused on, but it could be strength, it could be endurance, and so and certainly all the other things we talk about, including power. But we probably won't go that deep, because if you don't have the motion, you're not going to have all the others. So we need that. And so when you consider that a body resource as movement professionals, and certainly all of what we would call the Spoonerites and all your great practitioners, that what we need to do is say, can I identify, is there a particular tissue? And maybe we can, maybe we can't. But if we can see where there's a lack of movement and motion around a joint in a region, we have to restore that resource. And there are going to be a lot of options we'll talk about today regarding that. But the second part of your question is really the answer, and that is, that's now a resource that we have to try to facilitate the body utilizing. Just because the resource is there, it doesn't guarantee that the body will utilize that resource when it comes to executing a larger, more global functional movement. And so half of our job is getting the resource the way we want it, and the other half is making sure the body will utilize that. And a lot of that has to do with the proprioceptors that you mentioned.
Dave, when you say mobility, I think, okay, good. I have that covered. My patients do two sets of 30-second hamstring stretches in the cage. So I'm good, right?
Well, you know, I'm going to say, it depends. But you would do a three-dimensional hamstring stretch, and you probably wouldn't give them that exact dosage of reps and sets each time, but you would kind of fashion that based on the client. So that brings up the fact that everyone's an individual, so which adds to the it depends. But then when we're getting that lengthening, that force lengthening, the question becomes, how are you getting that? What's creating the motion that creates the stretch? Where's the force coming from? And then we go look deeper into, okay, is that appropriate for what they want to do? Is that appropriate for a word you mentioned, the transformational zone of the activity? And are we doing it in a way that would focus on either the proprioceptors, the neuroperceptual information, or as we've sort of discussed before this, is it just physically trying to take the tissues to a place that they need to go and making sure they can go there and doing it in a way that might increase what we would call the compliance of the tissue itself, its ability to lengthen in under a force, which is important for energy storage and energy return. So there's a lot of aspects to that, John, which you know when you ask the question, but I appreciate it.
So I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to throw it to you, John. Answer your own question, because again, I think this is something for our listeners to really contemplate, something that we've talked about since we started our podcast 7 years ago, of why are you doing what you're doing? And are you doing it because that's what you've always done? Or are you doing it because you have a true reason why you would give somebody two sets of 30 seconds on a hamstring stretch when there's the literature that may contradict that that's actually stretching tissue?
I think it was interesting talking about how we think about a muscle being stretched to end range and predominantly one plane. Maybe we tweak in a couple other planes. But if we look at the actual transformational zone of what that activity demands of our body, is that doing the patient justice of just stretching a muscle versus putting it in a transformational zone and, again, building off stability, mobility, proprioceptors in that zone?
Yeah, I'm more curious on the dosage of the exercise as well, because that's a question that I get asked from other therapists and technicians of, are we doing this for reps? Are we doing this for time? And I found that actually I like to go for at least over 2 minutes. A lot of the research that I've read on making acute fascial change has stated that you need maybe even close to 3 minutes of sustained tension on that tissue. So I usually use a clock or a watch when I have a client or a patient in a stretch cage or doing some sort of dynamic movement to help facilitate not only that kind of, I call it the marination of that tissue, but proprioceptively speaking, adding in the three planes of motion not only targets those proprioceptors more, but it engages that experience of just not just rocking back and forth for 3 minutes straight. I like going front to back in the sagittal plane for maybe 45 seconds, side to side frontal plane, 45 seconds, transverse plane, 45 seconds, and then maybe kind of finish it off in whatever power plane we're in. But just getting that triplanar component not only taps into the proprioception, taps more into that tissue sliding, gliding, but I think it makes it a more engaging experience for the patient as well.
You know, I think both of your comments are pertinent to the discussion and part of the answer. But, and you know, I love to talk about the proprioceptors, and we will. But even if you go back and say, what are you doing to the tissue? Yes, it needs to be sustained if you're really lengthening that tissue, and probably any tissue. But the question is, does it need to be constant over that period of time? Or is there a way to, as you were saying, go to a different plane? Even though you may have kept tension on in all three planes, as you change the movement during that sustained time, are you moving that in a different way? Or is it a gentle on and off, never completely off, but creating a message? Because we're really creating messages, whether it's physiologically to the tissue, to allow the gliding of the micro collagen fibrils, or is it to heal something by bringing in more circulation? And so sometimes we maybe need to think of what message are we trying to give, and that will give us some choices, but it may allow us to make the choice that might be most appropriate, because we know there are going to be a lot of choices about how to actually programmatically instruct the client how we want them to do it. I would just finish this little section by saying, sometimes the client tells us the answer to the dosage thing, and we have to pay attention to that. Not only look at when they gain, because I know when you're working with clients, all three of you, you can see that there's a sort of a over, very quickly some improvement. And then the question is that slows down. And maybe sometimes I make a mistake, because then when that slows down, I'm going to go off to a different plane or something else. And that's probably effective sometimes, because I'm not really looking for this long-term change that Brian was talking about. So leaving it when the benefits seem to have disappeared is not the appropriate choice for what you were talking about, Brian, but it may be the appropriate choice for what we're after today, in not really creating a physical change in the tissue, but maximizing what it's going to give us today as we now go out and work and train and play or whatever.
When would it be necessary to induce creep, right? We talk about that a lot, the 2 to 3 minutes. How would I know in the clinic whether I need to hold that sustained stretch for an extended period of time, or am I just, like you said, getting the quick gains and moving on? How would I know?
I wish I knew the answer to that, John. I think, again, I'm gonna apply my best biomechanical knowledge, and you guys have all read all that information and discussed it, but you also know that that leaves you short of the answer. It leaves you wanting a little bit more. And that's where the art comes into the science, to say, for this client, even if it was this client with the same diagnosis, the exact same problem, and you said this is what has worked all the time, or most of the time, most effectively, with this particular total scenario, you're going to find someone who responds differently. And so we always have to be evaluating our best program, because we all default to what we typically think works initially, because why wouldn't we? We're going to go to what experience tells us it works. But we have to be really prepared to say, okay, that's not optimal for this person, or I just got to tweak it a little, or I got to go a different way. And that's the great thing about the functional approach, is that there are so many different ways. It's bad because there are so many different ways, and we're going to discuss them here today and say, well, where's the answer? But the fact that you have those abilities to adjust for the individual is powerful, if we don't let all the potential ways of doing something in, you know, inhibit us and make us fearful that we don't know the exact answer.
So, Dave, I have a bit of an implied question here. Of, we've talked about kind of uniplanar stretching and mobilization, triplanar stretching, mobilization. We've obviously kind of casually referenced the stretch cage, but are there any other tools or methods that you like to go to when it comes to triplanar mobilization beyond just stretch cage and hands-on manual therapy?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, Brian. You're asking really questions about the Gray Institute. We were talking about, well, what's your strategy here? I have my favorites. They don't always work. But if I were working on a tri-dimensional or three-dimensional approach to something, but the real problem was, let's say, in the frontal plane of the, let's say, hip adductors, well, then I would often pre-position the plane of the greatest impairment. So I would put them in a position where we're taking up most of the range in that frontal plane to create the abduction to lengthen the adductors. But as you know, the adductors are three-dimensional muscles like all of them. But in doing that, you can either, if it's painful, you might then not actually go after that frontal plane directly. As you know, you would go in the sagittal or the transverse. But let's say it's not painful. I still feel that sometimes it's the preposition in the plane of the least mobility or motion or restriction. Drive the other two first, but then drive the third one. So for me, that's a default thing. Doesn't always work, as we just talked about, but that's kind of a default strategy. But your question also raises something that may bring up other things, is, well, what am I using now for the driver of those motions in the three planes? Is it the other leg? Is it the pelvis? Is it the arms? Is it the head? You know, because you've gone through the whole GIFT program and the training, is that those are options you have. And then John's going to say, well, which one's the best?
It depends.
Yes, and I can always get out of John's questions by it depends. But let me stop there and see where you guys think we need to, what we need
to. Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit, because I think it relates to creating mobility. And there's a component of stretching that's going to occur, and you're going to stimulate different types of proprioceptors within a muscle spindle, within a Golgi tendon organ at the tendon, because you're going to get some tension. You might get a little bit of, not to go super deep, but depending on speed of the motion, a Ruffini ending. And I think that that's an important component for people to think about, because if I preposition, let's go back to lengthening the adductors. It seems like everybody feels like they've got a tight groin at one point or the other, right? It's a common sports injury in certain sports, football, hockey, really common. And they feel after an injury that they have to stretch this all the time to feel loose. But going to your strategy of pre-positioning them in the plane of the least success, so the frontal plane in this situation, can you talk about how you may utilize speed or load, external load, to assist with engaging the proprioceptive system to allow the body to decrease threat and increase sense of motion?
Awesome question. I think speed is critical. I'm going to throw a curveball even to myself here and say that when we're going to the proprioceptors. Wait,
is that called a boomerang?
Could be. That's a boomerang question. When you're applying that one of many strategies that I talked about, you're at that point looking for the actual resource, the more mobility. And you're almost. Let's all think about this. You don't want the proprioceptors to inhibit you. So you're not really directing your tech. The strategy is to not let the proprioceptors come in and limit the motion. So if you don't go directly at the frontal plane abduction, then maybe the body says, oh, that's not, I don't need to defend that. So you go after the other one. Then all of a sudden you get more motion there because you're trying not to let the proprioceptors work because they're often the ones preventing the motion. So now once you get the resource, now you switch gears because now you're trying to bring in the proprioceptors and strategies and movements that will allow the body to use that. And that's, I think, where speed comes in a lot. But I often combine speed with the excursion of the motion. I often use the word range of motion, but that thinks of a number. And so I'm talking about the excursion, how far you're going into and out of the transformational zone. And I believe that, and this is probably anytime I say something I believe and this is the way it is, you know it's a generalization and obviously not true. But at least 100% of the time. I think the body likes shorter excursions better. And especially if you go to speed, that let's say I'll just throw out a number. Let's say you needed a movement where you were lunging with the other foot, the non-involved hip adductor, whatever. And so you needed to create in lunging with that foot, let's just say 30 degrees of abduction to have the effective movement, whatever it is, kicking a ball, doing something. If you have now through your mobility stuff, you have that 30 degrees, that's a resource. Now you have to teach the body how to use that. Not that speed doesn't impact getting the resource, but speed really, to me, in my limited whatever, my acumen of strategies, speed is something that I will pair with the excursion. That if I'm going through a large range of motion, I'll tend to have the person go slower because I think if you're going real fast, the body will do what you want it to do, slow it down, but before you're getting to that point where you really want to go. And so it's not 100%, but when if you really want to go real hard and fast into that TZ, I think my experience has been the body responds better to a much shorter excursion. But then you know that that might not be the real world. So now what do? You expand that excursion at a gradually with the speed, or you slow down the speed and use a bigger excursion. So you approach it from both ends. I hope that made some sense, but.
Yeah, I just want to paint the picture. So make sure I'm following along. I might take up the slack in the frontal plane through whatever motion the proprioceptive body is going to give me. But I know if I just bang my head against the wall there, I'm probably not going to make much progress. So are you saying then I would then translate my pelvis in the sagittal plane, take up some resources there that could either be fast or slow depending on the excursion distance, and then I might even tweak in rotations of my pelvis in the transverse plane, maybe at end range anterior, end range posterior sagittal plane translation, and that also could be fast or slow? That is a lot to think about.
Good practical question. And this is a limitation on my part. I don't think a lot about the speed when I'm using the other two planes as drivers. It doesn't mean that's not a mistake. Just being honest with you, John. But I do really think about it when I'm trying to get the body to use that resource once it's there. And so I might, again, utilize those other two planes as you well described. And I might, once I get it slow, I could add speed, then that might help. But, and again, I'm almost thinking as I'm answering these questions that I've been very limited in my use of these things. But I think that when I'm going directly after it that I'm really concerned about where in the range and through the excursion I'm having them work and the speed that I'm working at. And then, you know, Dan's question about the load comes in after that. I think those are three variables that we as movement professionals have to orchestrate to get success. And they're all important. And ultimately for function, it would be utilize the motion resource at a high speed under a load if that's what the activity requires. But to get there, you have to almost tone down one and use two and go through all these different combinations in order to be successful. But I want to be very clear right now. I've utilized that thought process mostly, as I just said, when I've got the resource and I'm going right after that abduction that they need in the functional transformational zone. But that doesn't mean I haven't been remiss at using those things when I'm just trying to get the resource, the mobility.
Gotcha. Yeah, I appreciate the clarification. In my mind, it seems to me that we are transitioning from mobility to stability at that point when we're increasing rate, increasing load to teach the body to adequately utilize the new resource that we've given it by increasing its mobility.
I would agree 100%. You know, at the Gray Institute, when we use the word stability, we're talking about a control of the motion, which provides local stability at the joint, but global stability of the movement. So those things are clearly important. And all of those few things that I listed are the strategies would be trying to work on that, trying to get that ultimately to the goal that we want, which, and I know Brian's going to hit us for something in a minute, but that would bring us to the question that we want to get to down the road, whenever, how many more minutes we want to keep going on this. But, you know, the idea is this, that abduction that we're just using as an example is almost never occurring in isolation. And it's always has the context of the activity that we're doing, whether it's a golf swing or something else. And so it's not only the amount of motion and controlling that motion, but where did you start? And where are you going and how much contribution in the other two planes? And so that's where even more of the things that you talked about, John, and the potential utilizing those variables that you mentioned, Dan, of load and speed all come into play. And even in, quote, what some might call overtraining or beyond that, you might go faster than you know the person's ever going to do it. And, you know, if you took the backswing in golf, Brian, and you said, that's not a real dynamic, fast motion when you're loading up that trail hip. But would you train someone a lot faster and a lot of things in order to enhance that resource so that it never peters out and it's there at hole 18. But that probably wasn't where you're going, but I thought I'd throw you that golf.
No, it's actually a kind of perfect segue of kind of how I wanted to wrap up this segment of, you know, where we're talking about the hip adductors. Let's say it's the left hip adductors that we're trying to mobilize. You had mentioned using a lunge of some sort, whether it's a lateral lunge or an anterior lunge. I'm curious, not only from you, and I know my answer, and I want to hear Dan and John as well. How would you specifically incorporate load towards that tissue? What does that look like? You know, what tool are you using? What movement are you doing? Is it a dumbbell? Is it a cable? Like, can you provide an example of what doing a loaded movement like that would look like? And after you give your answer, we'll chime in with ours.
Okay. Well, again, something that's pertinent to all of us, because if we want to overtrain to have a resource that's not sufficient for one or two reps or two holes on the golf course or something. So if we're talking about the left adductors, because you know your golf, and we're talking about getting the pelvis to move so that we can load into the backswing, you know, I can get the mobility, but your question is, well, how do you load that? And I'm not going to say it depends. I'm going to say that there's no better reason. Let's try everything we can. So you could have some kind of cable column that's attached to the pelvis that drives the pelvis over while you step, but you can still put your foot on the ground. More challenging, I guess, would be putting that cable resistance on the trail or the right foot for the right-handed golfer and being able to take that out and bring it back. A little bit easier, and maybe where we'd start, is the load in the hands, so that we would do something that is not authentic to the golf swing, but we would take our hands in a right-handed golfer to the left to create more of that abduction, getting the adductor to lengthen and let the pelvis to release, so in order to really load that backswing. And then you start tweaking the foot. Okay, so let's say I had a core ball in my hands and I'm overhead and I'm going to the left as I take my right foot and I step right lateral to the right. Well, there's all kinds of things you can do, but it could be a step first, then it could be a toe touch, then it could be no touch. You know all that in terms of the mobility to the stability. But you could even start to sequence that where you'd go, you know, because the person typically, let's say me, not probably being real strong in that, I'd really pretty much almost have my foot to the ground before I move the ball because I know I want that second foot on the ball on the ground for the stability. So you'll see people's body realize that's what they're going to have to do. So you say, hey, that is great. But, you know, what I'd like you to do is lift that foot, drive the weight, you know, to the left, then you can reach your foot out. So you can even, you know, tweak all of those things as we see how that person responds to that. But in loading, you know, those would be three ways to load it: through the pelvis, through the foot, and through the hands. And pretty traditional for a lot of things, but that still raises the question of what benefit would be to put that load in the transverse plane or in the sagittal plane. And you know, maybe what, you know, again, don't want to go too deep, but you know, we have the 3D rule of everything that you guys do. And so do you start in 3D, three planes and go to one, or do you start in one plane and go to three? Well, again, a general rule that I use that is wrong what a certain percentage of the time is that if I'm after mobility, I start one plane because that's going to be easier to get it, and then go to three. Now, the strategy we talked about before was driving in the other planes, but you're still going after that one plane of motion. But we know in almost everything, you're going to need three planes of motion. So having it in one doesn't mean you have it in three. So in that thing, you go from one, you get your success, then you combine two planes and then three planes. But if it's a stability problem, you think about it. Although we always try to be 3D, if you can use the other two planes to enhance the power of the muscle that's deficient, then your strategy would be start in 3D, which would seem more complex, go in three planes, and then gradually take away the plane so your focus on the muscle and that control and the stability is only in one.
I just have to laugh because you didn't see this, DT, but the whole time while you were just giving that explanation, watching John's facial expressions was comical as you're just blowing his mind. But I think it's something that, again, circling back to why this is a conversation we wanted to have and why we wanted to bring you in as the expert, is it's something that Brian and John and I have constantly had discussions about. Is, okay, great, we've given somebody more mobility, but the research is clear across all orthopedic literature that if you give a patient or a client more literature and you don't tell them how to use it, you're setting them up for the probability of getting hurt because they don't know where their body is in space. So that kinesthetic proprioceptive awareness is diminished. So back to Brian's point on the question of adding external load, that's something I think all three of us have thought about how we add external load. And I think your thought process, DT, on, you know, you can use it across the pelvis or you can use it further away from creating a lever arm, which sometimes may be easier, is something I feel like we've talked about a lot. But I do want to, you know, not to shut John off on his answer from Brian's perspective, but I do kind of want to go into now this thought process of, and for our final segment, of how do we train around a TZ? Because historically, the transformational zone where you go from, you know, not to go golf, but I think most people can think of a golf swing or a baseball swing. You take the club back and then you change directions. And when you change directions, is that kind of that transformational zone. So from a safety standpoint, and I have this written in my notes from, I guess this would have been 2021, excuse me. Training in the transformational zones can be safe if you've set up the success the right way. But let's talk about that and how we may load and stimulate in the transformational zone to assist with the resiliency so that they can obviously do it for two holes, but they need to be able to do it for 18, or they can do it for the first quarter of a basketball game, but they need to do it for four quarters of a basketball game, and then they need to do it repetitively over X number of games. I know that was a lot in that.
Well, it takes us kind of where we said we wanted to go, and that is that, first let me say that when that example of the three ways to the pelvis foot thing is, it wasn't all that authentic to whatever this person with the adductor thing wanted to do. But at that point, the goal was, let's get this motion loaded and see if we can control it. And then when you go to load, sometimes a load in the hand is more authentic because the person's activity has something loaded in their hands. Other times, something in their hands is not authentic because it's really a central core load. And so you would, that might be more appropriate, a vest or a weight belt or something. So all of those things enter in. But now your question really has brought us to, even though we probably don't have time to get into all the transformational zones, the idea is now we have to get to the proprioceptors. We have a resource, and let's just stick with the same example for anyone who's listening. We've got this ability to, for the body to allow the left hip to abduct. So the muscles either are just letting go of the adductors, or they're letting go with control, because that doesn't necessarily mean they're totally silent. But we've got that resource. Now we have to start moving towards the activities that the person wants to do. And we have to really consider, not that you haven't before, but consider the proprioceptors. What are we trying to turn on at that point? And I think that all of the variables that we have turn on certain proprioceptors. So if you're talking about speed, you know, the Ruffinis and other things are going to be firing more. If you're talking about load, then we're talking the muscle spindle, the Golgi tendon organs. Let's just talk about the GTOs for a second. And the fact that, you know, when you load, when a muscle's contracting under load to accomplish something, there's a tension in the GTO, or tension in the tendon, which can turn on the GTO. But the research seems to indicate that these GTOs have different thresholds for firing. And the initial work done on that was that, geez, if I, and they did this on anesthetized animals, live animals, but so they're monitoring one unit firing, and they lengthen the muscle by moving the limb. And the GTO fires, and it seems to go into the motor neuron pool, and it's inhibitory. So that brought out the initial conclusion that, well, these are protective organisms. These mechanoreceptors are going to protect us, and if the tension gets too high, they're going to inhibit the muscle and shut it down. And there's a tremendous amount of truth in that, but not as much importance to that. Because what we want to do is we want to do functional training with load in order for those GTOs to fire to provide not, oh, protect me, shut the muscle down, but, oh, no, we need to enhance the muscle a little more because a little more load here, we got to handle that. And so that's what happens when we actually train with greater loads. The body gets used to that information, and it's no longer seen as, you know, dangerous. It's no longer seen as something that needs to be avoided. Now, I'm speculating a little here, but I don't know if that adaptation occurs in the spinal cord at the central motor neuron pool where it's used to it so it doesn't respond and it's not negative, or if it happens in the tendon itself where the thresholds can shift and what's seen as the high threshold and dangerous changes. So there's a change that goes on there. And I'll just end this part, which was a little bit, you know, specific, was that the further research has showed that if you take that same animal, but you put them in a weight-bearing position and do the same lengthening, that same GTO fires and provides the same message. But when it goes to the motor neuron pool, it's facilitatory, not inhibitory. And so that's, why is that different? It's because what everything else is firing has, you know, set a gain or a situation in the spinal cord that says, wait a minute, you know, we need this. And that tells us we need more of that, not less of that. So again, that's a little abstract, but really important, really critical to realizing that we have to do things under weight bearing. We have to do things that are authentic to the function in order that the message that's received from, let's say, one particular mechanoreceptors is seen in the context of everything else that's firing, so the body knows how to respond.
I'm on board. Load in the transformational zone, facilitate proprioceptors, all that kind of stuff we talked about. Reconcile with me then why we would potentially try to build a buffer and train slightly outside of our transformational zone, and would that not be creating more of a gapposis if we're trying to move and groove that one specific TZ?
Yes, but so I would agree. If we're trying to groove it in and probably get our initial success, that we probably wouldn't want to have a lot of variability. And one of those variabilities might be going beyond the typical TZ. But once the person's able to do that, then we have to shift our strategy to create that effective and efficient movement to be more robust, meaning more effective in response to different initial conditions and different loads, different things. And so that's why you're right. You might want to be grooving it initially, and so you don't want to do that. But then once it's grooved, you want to bring in all these things, inhibit a particular joint from moving so that they have to use another joint more or do some other things that we know we vary the task in order to just create that ability to respond to different situations. And that makes the person that much better an athlete, whether they're the athlete that just wants to go down the stairs or they're an athlete that we see on TV. All that variability is there. But your point, not only being practical, but was saying there's a time and a place for some of these things. And maybe that, you know, just like, let's think you wanna jump up. And the best jumpers don't have to go far down before they can jump. They're able to marshal the resources to jump in a shorter excursion, which really means shorter period of time, so they can get up to that basketball before the other guy. And if you said, well, should I go further down? Well, sometimes you go further down just to make them successful, to load the muscles more, because the muscles aren't being turned on in the shortened range. They need to go to a larger, longer range, a more lengthening, more tension in the tendon, more stretch of the muscle spindle in order to get the activation. But we recognize as movement specialists, that's not functional, but we have to get the success. And then we bring them back. So that's one thing you're tweaking just to get to that initial success. Your question's the opposite. If they're really good in that short range, why would I ever take them to a deeper range? And it could be that sometime that's where they'll be, which was my initial answer. But it could be that there's some other training that we don't understand right there that they could provide a benefit, but not necessarily a guarantee of that.
So what I hear then, and where my brain goes to, is we still have to train where they're successful. We have to train in the range and load them appropriate to ensure that they are success for their given task. But I think back to a podcast that I did with Javier from Ignite Performance, and he talked about building movement abundance. And when you build movement abundance, then you probably, or his thought process is, you build more resiliency for the one situation where they're going to jump and somebody lands on top of them and they're forced into a zone that they aren't. And, you know, take Patrick Mahomes, for instance, right? Like, you watch him get in positions and you go, the vast majority of people would have gotten hurt. Why didn't he get hurt? Well, maybe he didn't get hurt because he's training into a range, going back to your point, John, of he's past the transformational zone. He's stimulating those with external load or principles of three-dimensionality, and he has built that signal into whatever the proprioceptor is, and most likely into the spinal segment, like you mentioned, to say this is not a threat. Therefore, I've built tissue resiliency, I've built movement resiliency so that I don't get injured.
Exactly, and I appreciate you've all three of you have tried to create some practicality to what I've said, but Now I'm going to take it another way. And Brian wanted to talk about the ability, the study that was done, and the ability to do speech and to say a syllable, just a simple syllable. And we know that you mentioned Mahomes. He's trained by a guy who went through GIFT but has his own training and brought his own skills to the things. But you see him throw a ball differently and you go, wow, he can do that. And it's accurate. And so you go, I wonder if they trained him that way. And I'd say partially. And because when you impose different either conscious restrictions on a task or things in the way, you're building this robustness. And the same way you tweak other variables, John, in order to build that, as you were intimating, Dan, you were saying, you know, that I see why we want to do that. But, you know, what Brian was referring to off the air before the podcast is there was a study done where you're saying a syllable. And when you think about speech, it's probably the most complex motor act we do. It's all the parts coming together to execute all these different vowels and sounds. And we put them together in a way that's a word, and we put it together in a way with a pause or something. I mean, it's amazing. And what they did in the study is, they had them say these syllables, and we don't have to get into the details. They sounded similar, but they required different levels of coordination of the vocal cords and the roof of the mouth and the tongue and the lips and everything else. And what they did was they had them in this apparatus, and they were doing EMG and everything, and they said, and they asked them to say it. And as soon as they went to say it, they would hit the jaw. The apparatus perturbated their jaw as they went to open their mouth to say it. And so it was preventing them from saying it their preferred way, the way we've grooved to make it effective and efficient, the preferred way, what we might have called the path of least resistance before. I would call it the path of most success. And that when we have this path of most success, we prefer it because it's also at the same time probably the path of least energy. So the easiest way to do it. But this apparatus didn't let them do that. And so what did they find? Well, they found out that they could still say it. So they were effective, if not the way they wanted to do it, maybe not as efficient. What they found was that the parts of the system that reorganized themselves, maybe the tongue did something different, the lips did something different, The vocal cords did something different. So they organized themselves in these synergies that we talk about, the good synergies, in a different way. Immediately, flexibly, able to put together a synergy that still says that. So, I mean, that's just, we think about that. It's just incredible that the body can do that. Here's what's more incredible. It happened in less time than the most simple reflex arc, less than 30 milliseconds. So it doesn't even go to the spinal cord. So that flexibility that we would like in all our athletes, no matter what age and what they're doing, maybe insurance doesn't allow us to do it if we're into reimbursement. But what we really do is once they're successful, the job's only half done. And then we've got to build that into it in order to challenge them, to make them do it a different way, to make it different, to change the load, to change the speed, to start them in a different range that wouldn't be authentic to function, and make them load from there. Or limit the range they can load in by sticking something behind them. We have to do all of those things that we know are parameters of a movement in order to build that, that flexibility that, as you referenced, Patrick Mahomes seems to be able to do. He can throw it at any angle at any time. Now, probably not everybody can do that, no matter how much they train. But it shows you that, and maybe it speaks to how important proprioception is, because although he practices all those things, I'm not one of these believers that if you do something 10,000 times, that's what you need. You know, maybe it's so many reps to have the flexibility, but you're never going to practice that angle of arm throw that many times. You might even get hurt doing that many times. So it's being able to have done something enough and being able to marshal those resources in many different ways in order to create something novel. That's the thing. If you see someone like that do certain things, they've never done it before in some cases. It's novel. How do you create a novel movement? Well, you have to have the resources and practice different things. And then some people are better than others at putting it together.
DT, we were just talking about Patrick Mahomes, but earlier we had referenced basketball and like a vertical. So something that I'm kind of pulling from kind of a collection of these conversations is, I probably want my athlete to, let's say we're doing strength training, we're doing back squats. I probably want them to do some reps or sets where I'm going full range of motion, you know, hips down as far as I possibly can. Then I might do a set where we're maybe half range, where they have to decelerate, you know, maybe hips get to about knee height, maybe a little less. But then I'm probably going to do some reps where they go only maybe a quarter or a third through their motion, capture that stretch shortening cycle of how they would actually jump. And then I might actually finish off with just some heel raises to kind of capture that final motion of a jump. So, you know, for me, that kind of helps us train not only the entire spectrum, or what was the term that Javier used?
Movement abundance,
right? It gives us the ability to adapt and be ready for if and when those moments happen that I do need that range. But it also allows us the ability to train the actual motion of how much range I would go through for an effective vertical. Is that kind of a good strategy that you would do?
I think it's a brilliant strategy, because you've considered multiple variables in doing that, and you know why you're doing it, and you're doing it in a sequence that seems to make sense. You could alter that sequence at some point, but you're starting with a sequence that makes total sense from a strategy standpoint. So I think that's great.
So quick wrap up here. First off, DT, thank you for taking the time to join us on this podcast. Hopefully our listeners are as engaged with this and take the time again, like we talked about so often, of step back, think about why you're doing what you're doing, evaluate the needs of the individuality of each client, understand the strategies that you're going to use to build success and build the framework of success in a session and throughout their plan of care. So first and foremost, thank you for joining us. We're very appreciative of that. But in quick summary, you know, we talked about a lot of different things, but don't forget the importance of creating mobility and the strategies to create mobility, the strategies then to help utilize speed, load, position to give the body a sense of stability, and then engaging the proprioceptors in a functional load-bearing, weight-bearing aspect to allow them to create the ability to actively engage and not create more confusion throughout the entirety of the specificity related to that given movement or task. Brian and John, I thank you for joining me again on this podcast as well. Your wisdom, your knowledge was something that I felt was necessary, so I was not completely overwhelmed during this podcast, as it could have gotten over my head real, real quick. So to the three of you, again, thank you. We are very grateful for you. You know, as always, if you have questions, comments, feedback, or additional topics, please do not hesitate to reach out to us at therapistinmotion@spoonerpt.com. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Please hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app.